Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research today. It is celebrating its 10th anniversary, and so we'll be looking at what the organization has accomplished, what lies ahead, what's the future of it, and what's the future of that sort of energy. And really glad to have a couple of guests with you today. John Greenler back, Tim Donahue back as well. John directs education and outreach at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Tim is the director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and professor in the Department of Bacteriology at the UW-Madison. You may have some questions about biofuels or the Wisconsin Energy Institute, other research, and certainly what's going on at the what we call the GLBRC, and I hope you'll call in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. John Greenler, welcome back.
Great, always great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
And Tim Donahue, welcome back to you as well.
Larry, thanks for having me. It's been too long.
Yeah, here we are 10 years older. You were here 10 years ago.
I was. John looks a little older. You and I look about the same we did 10 years ago. So.
Oh, man. I think it's worth reviewing. You came on when the GLBRC, or Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, started. Talk about how it got started.
So Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center was funded by the Bush administration, Bush 43, in 2007, as a program to decrease our dependency on foreign imported oil to make fuels, and now more and more fuels and chemicals. We'll talk about that a little later. It's been funded for 10 years now in its first contract. About a year ago, the Department of Energy put out a call for a new round of funding of what they call the Bioenergy Research Centers. We are one of three in the United States. And we submitted an application in the end of September and found out over the summer that we were approved for funding. Our next phase of funding is ready to kick off actually on Friday, December 1st. So we're pretty excited about rolling out a whole new center and building on the foundation of the last 10 years of success.
Yeah, and as you look at those 10 years, what would be highlights or achievements that you think have been made over those 10 years?
Well, so at a very high level, 10 years ago, I think I sat here with Molly John, who was the dean of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at that point, and there was a lot of buzz about cellulosic biofuels and the potential for them to replace fossil fuels, particularly in the automotive market. And here we are 10 years later, and there actually are cellulosic biofuel refineries in the United States, in Iowa and Kansas, that have opened in the last year or two, where we're actually processing corn stalks, or stover, for any of our farmers who are on the line today, or corn cobs into ethanol. So we are actually making cellulosic ethanol at scale in a small number of refineries in the United States. So the good news is this technology has come on board. There are some early adopters. We're not where we need to be yet, and there's a variety of reasons for that, but we're very proud of the fact that we can say a lot of exciting things have happened and there's more on the horizon moving forward.
Yeah. And John, I remember you talking too in the past about how this kind of the results of this kind of research are going to be kind of, there's not going to be one central place where all this happens or where all this production takes place, but around the country and probably in different forms depending on where you are.
That's exactly right. And really, that's a very desirable trait, the fact that making fuels from this fibrous plant material, or what we call cellulosic or lignocellulosic biomass, is really very adaptable, both in terms of different types of materials from different places in the country, whether it's forestry-based, either in our northern part of our state, or down in southeast part of the country, where there's some commercial scale-up as well, but also to meet varying demand, here nationally, but also globally as well. So that's, that adaptability, that resilience, I think, is one of the exciting success stories in a larger framework.
Yeah, and you mentioned Iowa, and that seems like a pretty good place to, if you're going to put that sort of a setup in a place that grows corn like the state of Iowa grows corn.
Yeah, and that's actually what the industry has done. If you think of where we process a lot of corn starch into ethanol and other products, it's in the middle of the Corn Belt, right, in Iowa and Illinois. And so these cellulosic plants or refineries have grown out of the ground and been sited literally right next door or right across the street, if you will, from existing large commercial starch ethanol plants. And that makes sense, because those facilities, those towns and cities and communities have the infrastructure to rail the biomass in.
Yeah.
And they split it, and the starch goes to one refinery, the cellulose goes to another one, and out of the rear end of those two refineries comes similar products, if you will, to... In this case, ethanol, to be blended into fuels for the automotive industry.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. Down the road, we see a different future where non-food crops will be processed, wood chips, switchgrass, native perennials will be processed at more local or regional biorefineries, using dedicated energy crops grown on non-food grade, non-agricultural land. And we estimate, for example, that you could site almost 40 of those in the north central region of the United States to make fuels and chemicals in the future.
And what are we talking, let's say 40 of those, if you look at what kind of... how much they could serve, or how many automobiles or whatever could they serve?
So 40 of those could service a lot of people in the north central region. We estimate, based on the cost of a lignocellulosic ethanol refinery, that each one of those refineries would cost upwards of a third to a half a billion, would it be, dollars to build. They would each be located within a 50-mile radius of where the biomass is grown. So there's jobs to construct those refineries. There's jobs to transport that biomass to the refinery, just like in Wisconsin. There's jobs to transport milk to the co-ops where it's processed. There's then products that come out of those that would be locally grown fuels and chemicals, not just fuels for the automotive industry, Larry, because more and more we're moving out of the production of ethanol and moving into the production of hydrocarbons that would burn in the automotive sector, in the small engine sector, in states like, we have a lot of small engine manufacturers in Wisconsin, in the aviation, in the long-haul diesel shipping, as well as in naval diesel. That's really a longer, larger play for these bioenergy centers than just making ethanol.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to add, it is highly, as we were talking earlier, it's, very diversified in terms of that material. But it's interesting, the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, is a couple times now, there's actually a second version of what they call their billion-ton study, where they really look, nationally at, what's out there, how much would be available. It ends up being about 1.3 billion tons, is the latest estimate that I've heard. And when you then, calculate out in terms of how much fuel would that be, that could be replacing as much as a third of the petroleum, resources that we use for transportation. So it's a big number.
That's a big number.
It's a big number.
Talking today with Tim Donahue and John Greenler from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and also the Wisconsin Energy Institute, taking a look at what's new in bioenergy research. We've been focused a little on the background of the GLBRC and now talking about the research that's been going on. Scott in New Berlin has a question, but there's a line open for you as well. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And Scott in New Berlin, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I'm all for all kinds of diverse energy sources, but the problem is ethanol is a terrible fuel for an internal combustion engine. You put 10% of that in your tank, you get 10% worse gas mileage. And at UW just came out with a big study that showed it's a net negative. And if we can make gasoline or diesel out of corn or some other force, great. But alcohol is a terrible fuel. There was more alcohol than was gasoline, you know, back at the turn of the last century. But gasoline won out because alcohol is terrible to put in a gasoline engine. And so I'd like to see the biodiversity thing go in a different direction than stuffing ethanol down our tanks, which we don't want.
All right. And, Scott, how do you really feel about that? No, just kidding. Just kidding. Let's get some comments from our guests today. Tim Donahue?
So, Scott, I think you raise a variety of really important points, but and so let me try to at least take one of them and address it in a way that hopefully you'll be happy with. My first comment is that the ethanol that we put in our cars is there as something called an oxygenate. It's there to help us be able to burn the hydrocarbons that come from fossil fuels more efficiently and more cleanly. It's been in there since I was a young man and going to college in the so-called Middle East fuel embargo. We started burning ethanol in big cities like San Francisco, New York City, where I grew up, in Washington, D.C., to try and increase combustion and to cut down on smog and haze from the automotive sector. So in the U.S., we're only burning a little bit of ethanol, and it's basically to try and keep the combustion high and the pollution from automotive industries down. In other countries like Brazil, they are actually using ethanol as the primary fuel. It's about 85% ethanol. So there's a difference in approach between what's going on in the U.S. and what's going on in Brazil. And I'll be honest with you, we're never going to be at 85% ethanol in the automotive sector in the U.S. because we just don't have enough biomass to produce that much. As John said a moment ago, at the most aggressive targets that USDA and DOE puts out there, we hope to be able to replace 30% of the gasoline with bio-based fuels. Moving forward, we're not doing anything with ethanol anymore. We're moving into making other types of compounds, as I said a minute ago, that will replace the hydrocarbon fraction of the fuel that we currently get from the Gulf or of Mexico or from the other Gulf or from elsewhere in the world. And those fuels will actually burn in both automotive and non-automotive engines. So we're going in exactly the direction that you're talking about. And we did that because we felt it was the right play. And we also did that because DOE, in their last call for funding, said they wanted us to work on non-ethanol fuels. So they gave us a mandate to get out of ethanol. So your tax dollars are going exactly where you say they should be going.
Yeah.
You know, it is interesting. When we look at the future of transportation, you know, we don't see it now. We see a little bit of it. But, for example, you know, ethanol really is largely going, you know, to, you know, replace gasoline. And really, you know, in our small vehicles that we drive around, and it's becoming increasingly clear that the EV, the electric vehicle market, will really rapidly, you know, move in there. And so we do look to the future, you know, as Tim was saying earlier, things like diesel for, you know, the heavy, the long heavy haul trucking and aviation are really going to be more of the pinch point in terms of needing those liquid fuels as we look towards the future. So, you know, that's the place for us to be.
Thanks a lot for that call. Tim Donahue, John Greenler, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll be taking our monthly check-in with the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. So I hope you'll stay around for that. We'll talk about some recent storms and answer your questions. And I think we'll zero in a little bit on wind as well. But right now, taking a look at what's new in bioenergy research with Tim Donahue, directs the GLBRC and is also the acting director right now of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. John Greenler directs education for both of those units, and great to have them here. You can join in 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Greg and Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Greg. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. It's my understanding that corn is a pretty energy and water intensive plant to be making cellulosic fuels out of, and I'm wondering why or when we're planning on moving past that to things like switchgrass.
Yeah,
so that's a great question. I'm going to try to give you an answer in two parts, and then explain why there's two parts to the answer. I think there will be. If you go back to the point that John made a minute ago, that there's over a billion tons of lignocellulosic material produced in the United States every year, several hundred million of those tons is in crop residue, in particular corn, that we're going to continue to need to grow to produce food for animals and people. So I think there will be a continued ability to make fuels and chemicals from corn stalks and corn cobs. And there will be producers who are aggregating corn to get the starch and make fuels and chemicals that will want their businesses to make products out of the stover and the cobs. But more and more down the road, we are moving away from corn. We are moving in the so-called dedicated bioenergy crops. You mentioned one of them in switchgrass, and we have had activities in switchgrass all along. We are now moving more and more into things like switchgrass, into things like crop residues from forestry, wood chips, to other dedicated energy crops, like native prairies and perennials that can be grown on marginal lands that will not need to use corn-grade or food-grade land. In the answer to a previous question, I told the caller that DOE said, thou shalt not study ethanol in the request for proposals. DOE also said, thou shalt not study corn in these new centers. We were moving in that direction anyway. I think we pivoted a little more than we might have planned to based on the language and the funding opportunity announcement to move into other crops or dedicated energy crops that will not compete with food, things like corn. So I hope that two parts of my answer got to the bottom line of your question.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Greg, for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Eau Claire, let's go to you next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Before I ask my question, I just want to make a comment addressing a previous caller is that I burn E85 on occasion, actually a fair amount, in my Chevy Yukon. And I'll tell you, I know exactly what my 85 mileage is. I know what my regular gas mileage is. And there are plenty of times that on the market out there for 85 where I come out ahead because the price is lower in most cases for 85. And when you get that sweet spot where it's low enough that the reduction in your gas mileage is just economic sense to use the 85. Now, having said that, for these manufacturing plants, both the cellulosic as well as the regular corn grain, what's happening to the micronutrients that are being excluded in the manufacturing process to get to the cellulose and the starch? When they do that processing, what's happening to those micronutrients? Are they being brought back to the land or landfilled? Or just speak to that. And where are those essential micronutrients going?
All right. Thanks,
so,
Mike.
I would say I do not have firsthand knowledge of the answer to your question. It raises an important point. But what I can tell you is what I've read on the web. I have read on the web that these lignocellulosic refineries do indeed generate a fair amount of soil when they process the millions of tons of corn stalks and corn cobs that they need to process. And I have read on the web that that soil is being bagged and provided back to communities for gardens, for organic farming, or maybe not organic farming given the amount of pesticides that are in it, but provided back to farmers so that that land does not become stressed by the lack of those important micronutrients. I don't have firsthand information on what the fraction of the soil that comes in goes back and things like that. All I know is what I've read on the web. But that is a huge issue for us moving forward. When we think about things in Great Lakes Bioenergy and the other centers, because it really gets to the long-term sustainability of this enterprise. We want to avoid a repeat of the Dust Bowl, where processing this biomass off of these lands creates a situation where soil fertility and geochemistry and ecosystem services are compromised, and we repeat the horrendous events that happened almost 100 years ago now when agricultural practices weren't sustainable.
Yeah. John, did you want to add to that?
Just, you know, one small piece, you know, as we look forward to moving away from these annual crops to perennials, such as switchgrass, which we've touched on, one of the things that the perennials do, which I think is so valuable, is a lot of those micronutrients that are in the growing above ground portion of the plant actually get transferred down below ground into the root system for storage essentially over winter when the plant is dormant. And so we end up having the plant that can actually, you know, retain those nutrients. And so a lot of them just never end up getting to the refinery or actually where they're a problem. Those micronutrients / minerals can be a problem in terms of the processing. So by moving to more perennial type systems, we're actually able to, you know, to really mitigate a lot of that challenge. So and then we use less fertilizers, which means less energy, less inputs, much better for the environment.
Yeah. Excellent. Nick and Kakana, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I've always been really interested in hemp. I know it can be used for many, many things. I know they can use it, turn it into biodiesel, construction products. I'm just wondering if you guys have been looking into that at all, since now it's you can grow it in Wisconsin with the permit.
Yeah.
We do not have a large program centered around looking at hemp. We have been looking at things that are very productive, that can be grown on non-agricultural land, in particular those that require very little or no fertilizer inputs and no water inputs, and that will grow on non-food grade land. Mm-hmm. But that's a potential dedicated energy crop. It's used for oil and other things now, that the technology we're developing, if in the best world, would be feedstock agnostic, and so it would work on just about anything you could grow at scale.
Yeah. Now,
you know, and one thing that's interesting is as hemp does continue to scale up, which there's a good chance it will, there will be a lot of residue material, very similar to the corn stover that we've been talking about. There'll be that fibrous residue material after that oil and similar has been extracted. And there's no reason, you know, why we couldn't, you know, make full use of that material and use that that residue or waste-like agricultural product.
Thanks, Nick, for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Ramsey and Waukesha a chance to join in. Ramsey, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Going back a little bit, I was your guest speaker was talking about that really that this biofuel will fill the niche for large hauling vehicles and airplanes. And I guess I wanted him to address Tesla. They just came out with a semi-truck that many of the large companies have purchased, and I'm wondering what he thinks of that.
So what
your answer off the air?
All right, thank you.
So that's another great question. What you're really getting at is in the future, what's the ratio or the mix of electrified vehicles compared to vehicles that run on what we think of today as liquid fuels. Electrification is clearly moving rapidly into the automotive industry for individual consumers. Electrification is moving into other areas as well. See a lot of electric buses in Madison. I don't know. I didn't look at your area code to know where you were calling from. There will be electrification of other fleets. I think electrification of long-haul shipping fleets is a very aggressive and exciting idea. It will require radical improvements in battery storage to get trucks that go from Chicago to Seattle on one or two stops overnight, and in infrastructure to provide charging stations for those long-haul drivers to pony up to, if you will, and instead of plugging their horses into a feed bag, plug in those long-haul diesel trucks into a charging station out in the middle of nowhere off the highways. I think that's something that I could see happening in the next number of decades, but maybe Larry and I won't be around to see all of that happening. We're a little long in the tooth, but it's the kind of stretch idea, the George Jetson technology, that we should be looking at as a country to diversify how we provide energy in the transportation sector.
Tim, your area of research is microbiology. What are some of the new ideas using microbes to produce fuels that would be an alternative to petroleum, perhaps?
Well, so I'll give you a couple of them. One of our very recent success stories is a company by the name of Lactic Solutions that was started by Jim Steele. Mm-hmm. Larry, you probably know or remember Jim as food science faculty member. We provided Jim with a little bit of money to work on what he could do to have lactic acid bacteria, which in Wisconsin we currently think about as making cheese, be actually a producer in the fuel industry. It turns out if you talk to people doing ethanol fermentations, whether it's the folks from Miller Coors making beer or people doing starch ethanol or people doing lignocellulosic ethanol, lactic acid bacteria are a major contaminant in those fermentations. And with a couple of gene tricks, Jim was able to take those contaminants and turn them into ethanol producers and actually increase the yield of ethanol that you get in aid fermentation. So not only did you get rid of a contaminant, but you made the process more economically feasible. Jim,
that's very cool.
Jim organized a startup company about a year ago that's already been bought out by one of the major ethanol producers in the U.S., and I can see mixed fermentations in the future being used to make ethanol and other fuels, just like mixed fermentations are used to make cheese, right?
There we go. Very cool. David in New Richmond. By the way, you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. And now on to David in New Richmond. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. So I just wanted to comment on the caller who said ethanol is not good in the vehicles. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, when the EPA came out with the mandate to make a fuel that was cleaner, Midwest scientists and universities got together with farmers, and they produced this product of ethanol that is able to function with gasoline, and they somehow make it work somewhat with gas engines. And the problem when you bring up these alternative products is the average farmer can look at his corn crop and say, I can look in the Chicago Board of Trade and see what corn is selling for. You can't do that with switchgrass, hemp, or any other kind of alternative fuel. And that's why it's mostly produced, you know, that's why it's, but they're tweaking it with these things that you just brought up, lactic solutions. You know, it's not the ideal answer, but it is an answer to what the EPA required. And to me, I was just down in New Hampton, Iowa this past weekend, filling up my wife's pickup truck, and I used the ethanol, the 85%, and I had a farmer, it was a Senex, and he walked up to me and he said, thank you for using that fuel. I'm a member of the ethanol plant, and I sell my corn to them, which is 12 miles away from here. And I've never had any other oil producer thank me for using their product. I know it employs U.S. people, and right now it's the only product that can be produced massively where the grower also knows I've got an alternative market for this product if I do not sell it to the ethanol industry. And, you know, people can bash this stuff all they want, but it's proven to work. It's not ideal, and that's kind of my two cents.
All right. David, thanks so much for calling. Comments?
No, I think, you know, I try to stay out of the line of fire when it comes to whether ethanol is or isn't a good replacement. I just come back to the science. The science is it's there to help us burn fuel more efficiently as an oxygenate. We're working on different sets of molecules that will be compatible with current engines, will be compatible with current fuels. We don't want people to have to trade in all of their pickup trucks to drive on biofuels, right?
Right.
Nor do we want the airline industry to have to hand in all of their 747s and jets that they have now, because to do that would be a huge infrastructure change. The compounds we make should be miscible with, compatible with, and combustible with all of the fuels that we're currently getting out of a barrel of oil.
Dean on Facebook wonders if Wisconsin is a good candidate area to start up biomass refineries and who might do so. Is Lake Michigan or any Great Lake a good candidate for wave energy, and whether or not you've done anything on that?
So let me try that in two pieces. As I said when we started, we've been able to model how much dedicated bioenergy crops could be grown in the north central region. This is not corn. I'm not leaving corn off, but I'm saying non-corn-based crops. We could cite almost 40 of these 30 million gallon a year dedicated bioenergy refineries in the north central region. Several of those are in Wisconsin and in Michigan and the UP of Michigan. That would be fed, if you will, by forestry waste, dedicated bioenergy crops like switchgrass and perennial native prairies that would be responsibly moved. The potential is there to grow a whole new industry in Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota and the Dakotas and even Iowa in land that isn't productive enough, and Illinois for farming. So there's a huge rural job opportunity here for that.
Go ahead. Sorry, Tom.
The other half of the question moves me out of bioenergy when he talks about wave energy. And there is also a huge potential for other sorts of new energy technologies in the Midwest, whether it's wave energy off of Lake Michigan, whether it's wind or solar. I forget where your caller was from, but one could look at yesterday's Madison newspaper, which picked up a story from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and the title of it was "For Clean Energy Jobs, the Sky's the Limit."
Yeah.
It talks about the potential, not the potential, the fact that clean energy jobs are the largest growing sector in the Midwest. And most of that so far has been driven by wind. There's a huge potential for solar, and there's a huge potential for other forms of energy, including wave energy, to be employers and rural jobs and rural economic development in the north central region of the United States.
You know, we have, we still got a minute or two left here, but just looking ahead now, you're starting another 5 years on this. What will success look like in 5 years?
So success in 5 years will be a potential for us to have these lignocellulosic biorefineries. And I use those terms for a variety of reasons. They're very different than an ethanol plant. These will be refineries that make fuels and chemicals, much like a petroleum refinery in the Gulf of Mexico today makes fuels and chemicals. The economics of that will be very different. We've talked about how much it would cost to build. We've talked about how many jobs it would create for aggregation and distribution of the feedstock, and then jobs to move it out. But I really see a day where in 5 or 10 years, people from the state of Wisconsin would be driving to Indianapolis this weekend to watch the Badgers in the Big Ten championship game on locally grown, on fuels that are made in Wisconsin from Wisconsin biomass. That would provide revenue for biomass producers. We currently call them farmers, but this is a next generation of farmers that grow both crops and dedicated energy crops as well as food crops and chemicals. So it would be a very different place.
Yeah.
And maybe someday they'd be going to a pack of Super Bowl game as well. This might not be the best year for that.
It might not be the best year for it. I want one more thing here as we conclude, John. I'm involved in a little event tomorrow at the Wisconsin Energy Institute.
Exactly. And we're going to be talking about what we're doing right now, and that is kind of looking at the what we know about communications and the media around energy. Yes. So tomorrow at 4:30 in the Wisconsin Energy Institute building, Larry, we're really glad you're going to be moderating a discussion with a really diverse panel looking at how we talk about energy and how we make sure we understand how it fits into our long-term systems and how it fits into our world, all the complexities.
That's right here in Madison, 4:30 tomorrow.
That's correct.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks, guys. Hopefully it won't be another 10 years, Tim, before you stop by.
Well, I've been here more than once in 10 years, but I'd love to come in anytime. Larry, I think this show does a great job getting questions in from people. Yep. A part of what we need to do is communicate more about what's going on, what technological advances can really help us in the state of Wisconsin. I think there was a Michigan caller I forgot to mention. Unfortunately, there's probably not a lot of Michigan people driving to Indianapolis this weekend, but we'll leave that as it may. I'd love to come back at any time in the near future.
And John, I know you're going to be back too. So
absolutely. And in the interim, for more information, glbrc.org and energy.wisc.edu. And if you are interested in tomorrow's event, going to that WI website is a great place to get additional information.
I think we have links on our Facebook page as well. Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks again, Larry.
Tim Donahue is director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison, and John Greenler directs education programs at the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Tim is also an acting director of that Energy Institute as well. They're great fun having them along, and we'll do it again. Well, we talked a little bit about wind energy, and we've had some strong winds lately, and our weather guys, John Martin, Steve Ackerman, coming up next. They'll talk about strong winds and all kinds of climate and weather things. You stay with us.